From the campus of Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, we invite you to listen to the Chapel Platform. Speakers at chapel and worship services have guided believers in scriptural truths for more than 70 years. Our speaker today is Dr. Les Olala, who is the president of Northland Baptist Bible College in Dunbar, Wisconsin. He delivered this sermon at a Bible conference service held at the university on Monday evening, March 20, 1995. His text is taken from Genesis chapters 37 and 39. Let's listen to his message with principles appropriate for any time, titled, How to Survive the 90s.
Let's turn to Genesis chapter 37. I want to speak tonight on how to survive the 90s. I will tell you what King Henry VIII told his seventh wife, I will not keep you long. So I will be conscious of that clock. Just to let you know, I do know a little bit Shakespeare. We live in a confused age. Chicago, Illinois, a 13-year-old boy, less than 90 pounds, was found in a pool of his own blood, frozen under a railroad trestle, shot by fellow gang members. This 13-year-old boy was a hitman for a gang in Chicago. Because in a shootout, he shot a child accidentally. They killed him because it embarrassed the gang. A couple of weeks ago in Pennsylvania, two boys were disciplined by the parents. The automobile was taken away. And they thought, that's an easy problem to solve. We'll just go and kill mom and dad. And they killed mom and dad, and they killed a little brother. They were captured in the woods behind a farm in Hope, Michigan. Picked up the newspaper in Detroit a couple of weeks ago, and there was a sign of religious confusion. Church says the people are turned off by the Bible. So they started a program called Saturday Night Live with live rock music, live entertainment, no Bible. Because a Bible will turn people off. So consequently, you don't want to open the Bible, lest people would not come. And they justify it by saying at least people are in the church. An age of religious confusion. Educational realms in mass confusion. How do we survive a generation that has turned its back on God? I'd like us to consider the life of Joseph tonight for just a moment and consider the character of this man. The creation of the universe was given five words in the Bible, and he made the stars also. The creation of the entire universe, five words. But the character of Joseph received one-fourth of the book of Genesis. Something is about this man that I believe we can learn. It has never been easy to be a Christian. Things have never been easy to be on God's side. But thank the Lord, we have ample opportunities to learn from Bible characters. And I think tonight we must learn from this man, Joseph. How did he survive the adversities that came to him in life? Number one, I want to point out before we look into the text, Joseph had conviction before he ever faced a crisis. He had developed a pattern of doing the right thing all the time. How can you survive a generation that is going cross-grain to God's truth? You must do what Joseph did. You must have conviction built into your life before crisis ever comes your way. We see that Joseph developed a pattern. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 2, and these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Joseph had a pattern right from youth to do the right thing all the time. He faced a major temptation in the land of Egypt. But before he faced that major crisis in Egypt, he had a pattern developed of faithfulness from those early years. First of all, he overcame the temptation to conform to the pressure of his brothers. In verse 2, it says, he was 17 years old, feeding the flock with his brethren. Now, they were wicked half-brothers. They were not godly men. These men were not helping Joseph to nurture into a mature follower of Jehovah. They were wicked, and I'm sure Joseph was pressured to conform to their lifestyle. Secondly, he was tempted to conceal. It says he came back to his father with their evil report. As a teenager, he was not afraid to rat on his brothers. You know, oftentimes in a college setting, in a Christian high school setting, people say, I know someone is in sin. I know someone is in walking in disobedience. But I'm not going to rat on him. Let me tell you something, student. If you love someone, and you know that individual is willfully walking away from God, you'd better report that need to somebody. Why did Joseph come back to Jacob, his father, with the report of the evil deeds of the brethren? Because he was concerned about their lives. He was concerned about their family's future, and he was concerned about the future of the nation. It is not a loving person and a concerned person regarding the family and this nation who would conceal the evil of those who are going in the wrong direction. So he formed the pattern to resist the temptation to conform and to conceal. Then he overcame the temptation to contend. He did not contend with his brothers. He did not become argumentative to fight back, to get even. You see the pattern? He had a focus upon God. And he overcame the temptation to complain. My, how he could have gotten bitter. Interestingly, when God gave him children, the first child was named Manasseh, which means forgetting. Joseph proved that no bitter experience of the past would cause him to lose the blessing of God in the present. Many people are in bitterness. They cannot forget. And they complain, thinking God has dealt them a bad hand. He had conviction before he ever faced a crisis. Right from youth, he built in that belief. Not only do we see a pattern, we see a purpose. Chapter 37, God gave Joseph a dream. And that dream indicated that he was going to be a leader and the brothers would be bowing down to him, and somehow God was going to send him on ahead as a preserver of his family and as a preserver of that nation. He had an unusual drive in him. He had unusual dress and certainly had an unusual dream. But when he told the dream to his wicked brothers, it went over like a piano in the Church of Christ. They said, you are going to do what? And we are going to do what? And so, he had that purpose clearly fixed in his mind. What do you believe? What do you believe if someone took you out on a business trip and offered you a social drink? Do you have your mind made up before that crisis comes along? What if you get into a situation on a date and the situation develops into what can become an ungodly thing and you can't be making up your mind what you believe at that point? It must be made up now. I was called by the Iron Mountain High School football coach. He built a great football program in a high school in Upper Michigan, about 25 miles from our institution. This man is an unsaved man, but he has gotten very interested in what God is doing down where we are. He called me to come to speak to his football team for the last 3 years before they go on to the championship games and then finally to the state championship. I went into the locker room and spoke to the football players after practice before they went for their final game before the state championship, which they won. He wanted me to speak to the team on anything that I would choose. And I talked about doing the right thing always on every play and paralleled it with life. I said, if you are going to win a championship banner, you cannot be thinking when you are the quarterback about a banner hanging in your gymnasium. You have to be thinking what you are going to do on that play. I said, if you are an end, you cannot be thinking what a trophy in the cabinet will look like when you are to be going out and doing what you are supposed to be doing on that play. I said, the key to winning championship games is every player doing what he is supposed to do on every play. Otherwise, you look at the Green Bay Packers. And they're close enough to Packer country where they could relate. I came out of surgery that I had on my shoulder a few years back, and I was in a recovery room of a large university hospital. Several people coming out of surgery, and they were moaning, and I was too. I woke up hearing myself moaning. I was like, oh, ooh. And the whole room was filled, and the nurse came and said, are you okay? I said, it sounded like I'm at a Packer game, and I was barely awake. I said, after every play, that's what you always hear. Oh! So I explained that to this high school football team. If you want to play like the Packers, go ahead and think about banners, and don't do what you should do when you're supposed to be doing it. That team went down against the fastest running back in the state of Michigan. Small UP high school. Came back from the Silver Dome in Detroit, Michigan with a state championship, banners, trophy. The coach called back through one of our staff members and said, tell Les, we won the championship one play at a time. You know how you win in life? One choice at a time. You cannot make 5 right choices and then make 2 bad choices and say everything is going to be just as though I never made a bad choice. You better have conviction built into your life before a crisis ever comes along. Some of the people here know Alvin Dark when he was in professional baseball. Has 5 World Series rings. He told me that he and Sankey, the shortstop, would get a batter, a catcher, a first baseman, and they would have someone playing out in the field. He said they would practice hours and hours and hours after everyone else was done. He said we would practice many, many hours a week, way above and beyond others. And he said we would create a circumstance. We were pretending in a World Series game, runner at first, 2 men out. A runner at second, 1 man out. They created every scenario. And he said, we would go and run everything. He said, when we would get into World Series games, he said, when the ball came, we didn't have to stop and think what to do. He said, we had done the right thing so many times that when the crisis came, we automatically did what should have been done. How are you planning your life? How do you live? Do you have your conviction formed before a crisis situation comes up? Bruce Kimball, man who won the silver medal in the Los Angeles Summer Olympics, had a lifetime goal to win the gold medal. I was interested to see because Greg Louganis had won the gold medal and Bruce Kimball had won silver, and I knew Kimball had the goal to win the gold medal in the Seoul Korea Games. But he had to qualify for the team again. I got home one Sunday afternoon. I turned on the television to watch the diving trials, and they were listed. Bruce Kimball was down on number 5. He had one more dive to qualify. I watched as Kimball dove, and he had an excellent dive, but did not get enough points to get back up into the number 2 spot. He had to be number 1 or number 2 to go. He crawled out of the swimming pool and he went to the arms of his father, who was his Olympic coach. They embraced. He picked up his gym bag and went around the corner into the locker room. And I found out later what Bruce told his father during that embrace. He said, "Dad, I will never dive again." The cameras panned that arena. There were teenagers holding protest signs. Some of you may recall this. There were protest signs saying Bruce Kimball should not have been in the trials because while he was trying to qualify to win gold, they had friends who were in the grave. Because Bruce Kimball one night made a foolish choice. He took a bottle of liquor to his lips, got behind the wheel of his automobile and out of control into a crowd of teenagers, killing some of those young people, maiming some of those young people. When the trial began, witness number 1 was pictures of the scene that night with the bodies. Bruce Kimball, though he had pleaded not guilty, stood to his feet. And he said, "I'm guilty. Stop the trial. I don't want to put families through any more heartache. I am guilty." Because the next one to come to the stand was the boy riding with him that night. He was to testify that when Bruce Kimball brought the car to a stop, he got out and he pounded his fist on the fender and said, "There go the Olympics." No, friend, the Olympics were lost when he did not have the conviction to keep liquor away from the lips. No matter what your goal in life may be, you say, "I have a goal to pastor a great church," or "I have a goal to be a successful businessman. I have a goal to go to the mission field." Having a goal is one thing. But making the decisions along the way that get you to that goal is another matter. My heart was burdened for Bruce Kimball. I thought if there's somehow we could get the gospel to him. And I was preaching at the Wilds summer before last, and I used this illustration, and a youth pastor from Florida came and said, "You'll be encouraged to hear that our church has a prison ministry and Bruce Kimball has accepted Christ in that Florida prison. He's in a Bible study with the pastor. New life, but boy, what a scar. College student, academy student, visitor. Why don't we just firmly commit to walking obediently so we don't have to bear the scars of wrong choosing? Not only did Joseph survive because he had developed a pattern of doing right all the time. Secondly, he had a holy fear of God and a fervent love for God. Let's move on to Genesis chapter 39. And we find the story now of Joseph having been sold by his family, taken down to Egypt. God's hand was on him. And he faces the greatest temptation of his life. He was a prosperous man, a man with high position, a man who was popular, a man with excellent physique. All of these elements set him for a major fall. Look down here in verse 6 of chapter 39. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me." Now he had a pattern of overcoming temptation to conform and to conceal and to complain. Now what would he do? A major temptation. This wife came and took this young man and said, "Come lie with me." What did she mean? Was she saying, "Joseph, Let's go downtown tonight and tell some lies. You lie about your age, I'll lie about my weight. Is that what she meant? I hardly think so. She was saying, Joseph, lie with me physically. And here was a young man. If you contrast the hatred of his brothers with the rapt attention this woman was giving him, from the standpoint of the flesh, he was in a perfect setup, except he had something else in his life. Besides conviction, he had a holy fear of God and a fervent love for God. What a great preserver. The fear of the Lord is to do what? Hate evil. You know what will protect you from evil? Fear in the Lord. Joseph was in a land that was a foreign land. And he said, how can I sin against God, that's Yahweh? Even in that foreign land, Joseph knew that God was there. The fear of the Lord is the conscious awareness of the presence of God. It is a comfort to the faithful. It is a conviction to those who are in disobedience. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. A few years back with our incoming students, I met with all new students. I said, there are some things we're taking out of our rule book. I said, one thing we're taking out of our rule book is the rule against eating dead skunks on campus. I said, that rule we had, we couldn't eat dead skunks. Another one, no eating out of the dumpster. We're taking that out. And I said, the one we had, it's on the bottom of page 3, I said, on maggot snacking in the dorms at night. And these kids were looking at me like, what? Like you are. Then I said, you know, really, that never was in the handbook. And do you know why we didn't have to put it in the handbook? Because you don't have to make a rule against something you hate. And I said, if only Christian high schools and if only Christian colleges across the United States of America had but one admission requirement, and that is that you fear God. I said, boy, could we have some fun. You know why you have to have rules and regulations? To protect us from ourselves. Until we mature in that fear of God and in that love for God. What is the basis of that holy fear and that fervent love? Well, first of all, it's the Word of God. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17. We find a requirement concerning kings. We'll begin reading there in verse 16 of Deuteronomy 17. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto me, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall ye multiply wives. That his heart turn not away. Neither shall he be greatly multiplied to himself silver and gold. And it shall be, when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of the law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life. Note this, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. That his heart not be lifted up above the brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Why were they to write a copy of the law? In order that they may learn to fear God, and that they may learn to obey God. What is the basis of that holy fear? Knowing God. Knowing him. Did Solomon keep that? This warning was given. Don't multiply horses, lest they become your point of confidence. Don't multiply wives, lest they turn your heart away from God. Solomon violated both in a big way. 700 wives. 300 combines. That is a big farm by anybody's standards. When he disobeyed, he went after it big. No wonder he said in Ecclesiastes 2:17, I hated life. Can you imagine 700 Visa cards? The Visa cards were the minor thing. The grieving God. And the direct disobedience, which indicated the lack of fear of God, is what so hurt Solomon. So the Word of God was key. And secondly, the worship of God. What helps a man to fear God and to fervently love Him? Number one, love His Word. Number two, learn to worship Him. The worship of God keeps the focus away from the idols that would draw the heart away from God. I thank God for this institution that has never wavered from commitment to obedience. For the more I look out in education circles, make you mad enough to mug an Avon lady with some of the things that are going on. What a refreshing time to be able to come back here and things have not changed. And I'm glad for the determination. It's better to shut down than to turn to Egypt. The book of Ezra would be a good book I would challenge you to study sometime. What did Zerubbabel put ahead of production? He put praise ahead of production. The worship of God before a block of the temple was laid, an altar was built. They worshiped the Lord, praised to Him, and prayer to Him. And in chapter 3 and 4, they put principle ahead of production. The world came in and said, let us build with you. And Zerubbabel said, you are not a part of this. And they said, we'll be a part of it. We'll hire attorneys and stop you. So they stopped the work of God for 16 years. But Zerubbabel put principle ahead of production. Then the hearts of the people became discouraged. And God sent Zechariah, who came and said, take heart. And Haggai, who came and said, take part. And the work of God was quickly completed. Then they put purity ahead of production. What a book on leadership. That has been an anchor to me so many times. Joseph worshipped God. In Genesis chapter 41 and verse 38, an ungodly king said, is there anyone like him in whom the Spirit of God is? Can that be said of you? Two great preservers, the fear of God, the fervent love for God. He says in chapter 39 and verse 9, after she said, lie with me, he refused and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? He was still shocked by sin. I hope in this wicked generation you will never get over being shocked by sin. We are bombarded constantly. Our senses are bombarded constantly. How will you live? What decision, what conviction will you have regarding videos? What conviction will you have regarding your music? Number three, Joseph survived because he had a sincere loyalty to his authority. Another great protector. He had a sincere loyalty to God-placed authority over him. Look what it says in verse 9. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee. Thou art his wife. He said, I will never be disloyal to the man under whom I serve. You know what, college student? academy student, you will save yourself a lot of grief in life if you'll just learn how to obey those God-placed authorities. It was no battle with Joseph because he said, "This isn't. How could I do this? Number one, God is grieved. And number two, I can't do this because I'm under authority." What do you do when authority gives an instruction? You know why people fall in the business world? It's because in college they set patterns that are not integrity patterns. It's just a natural thing when an opportunity comes to cheat. Then you just go ahead and cheat because it was a pattern. Unless you have already fixed in your mind, "I don't care if I lose my job. I don't care if I hurt financially. I'm going to do right." You assistant pastors going out into the ministry, your number one commitment under God has to be making that man above you a success. Students here in this institution, you'll be greatly served in your spiritual life if you will learn to say, "Yes, sir. No, sir," regarding things that you may not even understand. First thing that God gave to Adam after He created him was responsibility. And the second thing was restriction. Superabundant, yes. Of all the trees, eat freely. A solitary, no. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not. And Satan went after that single no and blinded them to the superabundant yes. So loyalty is based on responsibility, and loyalty is based on God-given restraint. You say, "Well, I'm going to be free and I will live the way I choose to live." Really? The only way you can keep from being destroyed is to be under authority. Obey them that have the rule over you. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and thy mother," which is the first commandment with promise, "that it may be well with thee, that thou mayest live long on the earth." There could be the premature removal when you decide to go your own way. Picked up the newspaper in Detroit a couple of years ago. There was a picture of a beautiful blonde. The inset picture of this blonde was in the corner of a larger picture, and the larger picture was a tombstone under a great big maple tree. And it said, "Beloved Stephanie," or "Stephanie Dubé, beloved daughter." Date of her birth, date of her death. The picture caught my attention, so I picked up the Detroit News and I began to read. This girl was from the Zoe Christian Academy in St. Clair Shores, Michigan. Father had left the home and she began to fight with her mother. She did not want to live with her mother's restraint. So she said, "I'm going to find freedom." Stephanie Dubé moved out of the home as a 14-year-old girl, moved in with some friends, and she was free. Began running with this group. They would go to this home where these men were. Two of these men were sitting around a table one day in this home and they said, "Why don't we kill Stephanie today?" They were talking about this as though you and I were going to McDonald's talking about what we plan to do for that day. Stephanie Dubé walked into the house by their own testimony after these men were caught. They killed Stephanie. They not only killed her, they skinned her. They took her head off and skinned her head and put the head in the freezer and waited for Stephanie's friends to come home so they could play a joke on her friends. They put this head in the freezer. And when Stephanie's friends came in, they said, "Open the freezer door." These girls opened and saw Stephanie's piercing blue eyes out of that skinned head. They screamed and ran, called the police. The men were captured, and in that home were books on Satanism and the occult. It was like a ritualistic killing to them. And Stephanie was running, this 14-year-old girl was running to freedom. But she played smack dab into the trap that the devil had for her. There may come a time when God says enough is enough. I was preaching in Chicago last summer, summer before last, and Ken Endine, a youth pastor, graduate of Bob Jones, is in First Baptist Church of Troy, Michigan. I used this illustration at that youth conference. He came up to me afterwards. He said, 2 weeks ago, Sunday night, I was down front during an invitation and a girl came sobbing down the aisle. I sent her to talk with my wife and my wife said, "Honey, what's wrong?" She said, "I can't get that head out of my mind." And that girl was now in First Baptist of Troy, one of the girls who found Stephanie's head in that freezer. 1 week, Stephanie was a student in Zoe Christian Academy. People in the academy said they never gave her, she never gave them a problem. But she determined she was not going to live under God-given restraint. You think you find freedom, but freedom is feeling comfortable in God-given restraint. Why was Joseph protected and how can we survive the 90s as Joseph survived his era? He had conviction before a crisis. He had a holy fear of God and a fervent love for God. He had a sincere loyalty to his authority. And then fourthly, he had the sense to avoid the source of sin. The temptation was perpetual. It says in verse 10 that she came day by day. And in verse 10, he says, "He hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her." Verse 15, it says, "And came to pass when she heard and lift up my voice and cried that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out." He ran. He had the sense to avoid the source. You know, as you go on in your position in life, faithfully doing what you are supposed to do as Joseph did, you don't know what unexpected crisis may come your way to cheat or to lie or to pull some kind of a shady deal. So instead of falling, he fled. He realized that retreat was better than defeat. "There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it." We received a phone call one night. Two of our students were picked up shoplifting at Shopko. Two students that had borderline attitudes. We began early morning prayer meeting, sensing something amiss. Shopko, like a Kmart, has the policy that if you're caught shoplifting, you go straight to jail. The students under deceit went into town. And when I talked to them, they were talking through a glass with a small hole, looking very meek. They were broken. They said, "Dr. O, would you read letters from us to the student body?" Here's one. "Dear student body, there are many things going through my mind." They're sitting in jail. "There are many things going through my mind right now. I'm very sorry for ruining the name of the school. Big lesson is being learned back here," meaning back in the jail cells. "The Lord has completely broken me. I am ready to be used. All I can tell you is, I am sorry and ask you to forgive me." They're writing to the student body. "I pray that you will not give up on me. I will be back. I will be better. The Lord is teaching me an unforgettable lesson. One point I would like to get across is that no matter where you are and what you are doing, the Lord sees you and He will judge," underscored. "I was waiting for the Lord to judge me, but I never thought it would be like this. You cannot hide from God. He will catch you to break you. I can only pray that those who are still doing wrong will see and realize that they are doing wrongly and will stop immediately. Listen to those in authority, especially your parents. They are there to help you, not hinder you. Please pray for me as I make everything right with my parents and others who have done wrong. Please forgive me and pray that I will learn the lesson. Don't give up on us. Then P.S., Dr. O, please say a special thanks to Jeremy Jans, who is at this time in Denver in a coma, was hit by an automobile during his pastoral internship. Special thanks to Jeremy Jans for trying to help me, be there for me. The other prisoner, dear student body, all I can say is I'm sorry for the wrong I've done. It's hard to write, to get a point across. By now, many of you know what has happened. Sitting in prison makes one think more than he does when he's sitting in the dean's office. I was broken and broken hard. Most of the time I sat in chapel and did not listen because I thought I knew better than faculty or staff. There are probably people out there that are still not listening, even after this. I thought I was invincible and the Lord couldn't touch me. I was wrong, dead wrong. I thought the Lord would only hurt me or my body, but instead, He ruined my pride, hurt my friends, my parents, my college's name, and most importantly, I ruined the name of Christ. I can only ask forgiveness. I can understand if you never want to see or hear from me again. I just want your forgiveness. Please forgive me. One more thing. The one thing that led me to my actions, listen to this. The one thing that led me to my actions was rock music. I was addicted, and I could not let go. Now I realize I was addicted. I know most of you think you can control your music, but until you are broken, you won't realize it. Please consider these facts. Learn your lesson before you are taught one. Two former students, broken, writing from a jail cell. Where do you stand? Are you ready to face the 90s? I hope so. Are you still battling hidden sin? You say the dean doesn't know, my hall people don't know, my roommates don't know. But you're living in deceit. Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Look what happened with Joseph. He was greatly respected and used of God to preserve himself, his family, his nation. Marsden writes, make every occasion a great occasion, because you never know when God may take your measure for a larger place. Your work should make you grow. You are constantly being measured. Each job prepares you for the next one. And the Lord moves and honors when He sees fit. Are you ready for the 90s? Conviction? Love and fear, loyalty, sense to stay away from sin. You've learned to run rather than confront that which you know will conquer you. I have a brother right now in a hospital fighting alcohol. I told him the worst place for an alcoholic, a drunkard, to have devotions is in a bar. The worst place for you to try to have victory is by plopping yourself in the middle of where you know you will face defeat. God loves you with a perfect love. Enjoy Him. Obey Him. Let Him be the Lord of your life. Get it straight. Don't live a life of misery and deceit. You be a Bob Jones student and a Bob Jones grad who will make a major difference in this generation. You have all the tools to do it. May God give you the strength to do it.
Thank you for joining us for the Chapel Platform. If you'd like a copy of today's message, send us a check for $6.50. You can mail your check to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Please mention the speaker, Dr. Les Olala. His name is spelled O-L-L-I-L-A. Also mention the title of the message, How to Survive the 90s, and today's date. Join us again for the Chapel Platform, sponsored by Bob Jones University.